Jeg vil gerne sige mange tak for lejligheden for at komme og tale om mit arbejde. So enough with the Scandinavian. For those of you who didn't understand, I just wanted to say thank you so much for inviting me to SIRPA and especially Katja from the Finnish Anthropological Association. Thank you for having me. It's been a, you know, wonderful pleasure to come to Finland. It's my first time, and I hope it will not be my last time. It's a very beautiful and very warm country, and so bright. In Denmark, it rains all the time, so maybe I've been lucky, but it's been great. My talk today, Migrant Underworlds, Travels in Hyper-Reality, is informed by ethnographic fieldworks in West Africa, in North Africa, Southern Europe, among Ghanaian undocumented migrants on the road to Italy via Niger and Libya. And how these journeys speak of the restrictive regimes of mobility that undocumented migrants come up against and to a certain extent challenge in the effort, in their desire to navigate the Euro-African borderlands and obtain a new lease on life by the dangerous means of travel available to them. So the plan here is to make a few opening remarks on mobility, on iconoclasm, and what I call hypo-reality, and then explore some of the ethnographic background to my work, the life and death on the migrant journey from Ghana to Italy via Niger and Libya. And just for clarification, the people leaving for Italy from Libya, the Ghanaian migrants, or the migrants in general, actually, is a mixed group of people with labor migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers all traveling together. But the migrants, the Ghanaian migrants that I focus on here, are all relatively young male labor migrants. So the migrant life world is a world where mobility is increasingly difficult to achieve, both social and economical mobility, but also physical mobility. The safe and legal roads are closed, and the roads offered by the smugglers are expensive and dangerous. And this development has, of course, taken place in contrast to a heightened phase of mobility in the more privileged parts of the world, where it has become easier and cheaper to travel almost everywhere one wants to go. This is a global world that appears to grow and to shrink at the same time, as the sociologist Stephen Castles argued about 20 years ago. He said, global linkages may affect every geographical area and every human group, yet only create deeper divisions and differences. Indeed, global linkages tend to create greater inclusion and greater exclusion at the same time, as some, and I quote, become full members in the new global order while others are marginalized. In the present age, this tendency appears to be intensifying and hardening. At the privileged end of the scale, we are talking about space-time compression, following David Harvey, where distances disappear and delays are eradicated to facilitate the easy flows of people and capital between the power centers of the world, whereas in other parts of the world, people experience a space-time expansion as distances grow and the waiting becomes endless. And necessary journeys become longer, harder, riskier, and more expensive if it's possible to move anywhere at all. At the same time, we should also remember that borders are proliferating. As Etienne Balibar has argued, borders are no longer at the border. You meet borders at railway stations, at shopping malls, at internet cafes, so on, so on. Borders are places that migrants come up against repeatedly. And you could even argue that the final border is a border within yourself. And we are seeing many Western governments very eager to install this internal border in migrants. Take, for instance, the Australian government and their attempt, the Danish government is doing the same, by the way, their attempt by running ads to crush the hope of migrants, telling them, you'll never be resettled here, you'll never be integrated, you'll never belong here. So also a crushing of hope, creating internal borders. Again, at the one end of the scale, we seem to increasingly live in the hyper-reality, not hypo, the hyper-reality that postmodernist thinkers like Umberto Eco and Jean Baudrillard predicted almost 40 years ago. This is a world in which reality and the representations of reality have been substituted by simulation and simulacra. Or, as Baudrillard argued, it's not even the question of making the map similar to the territory, but the fact that there is no but that there is no truer state of being or appearance, but that the map, the simulacra, is all there is, and the traces of the real are rotting away. And because the real is no longer what it used to be, nostalgia resumes its full meaning along with nihilism and spectacle. So hyper-reality is a media-saturated world where we are all extras in a reality show and where the pleasure principle has overcome the reality principle. So at the time, Baudrillard's assertion that we were experiencing this paradigmatic break with modernity and his notion of hyper-reality, and this was written well before the internet and the smartphone, at the time he wrote about hyper-reality, he was criticized for hyperbole and science fiction, but I guess in the present political reality in Europe and the US, his work has gained an ominous relevance, and the idea that we are all extras in a reality show somehow rings truer today. Yet, Susan Sontag's famous critique of Baudrillard that his notion of hyper-reality is a form of provincialism is a strong criticism because obviously we can't universalize experience of life in the privileged media-saturated world when in fact the vast majority of people on the earth live lives that are in no way liberated from the reality principle and where hopes and dreams are constantly put on hold or indefinitely postponed. Young West African migrants, for instance, may aspire to become part of the bright world of hyper-reality, and many, even in poor villages, have Twitter and Facebook accounts where they live out various personas and follow the global dispersion of images. Yet the means to fulfill their dreams are slipping out of their hands. The whispers of globalization, for lack of a better word, runs quickly from house to house, from hot to hot, but the actual circulation of money, jobs, and technology is taking place between the usual power centers of the world. The gravity of this situation, of the constant teasing whispers of promise, cannot be underestimated. To paraphrase Baudrillard and Umberto Eco, we could then say that parallel to the world of hyper-reality, perhaps even as a constitutional consequence of it, another form of reality is emerging that I would call hypo-reality, from the Greek word for under. In hypo-reality, unlike in hyper-reality, lives are short and underwhelming, not because of lack of effort or talent. West African migrants try harder and they think faster than most people I've met, but they come up against barriers everywhere they turn. Hard, dangerous borders that selectively designate lives based on categories such as race, ethnicity, and religion. Those who make it across the Mediterranean are likely to live underground lives characterized by the subordinate, substandard, and ultimately subhuman conditions of hyperreality. Unlike in the world of hyperreality, dream and fantasy does not merge with reality, but are kept in check by reality. And on an everyday level, migrants have to settle for less. When the West African migrant dreams of something different, a better life, economically, socially, and existentially, he or she is not just up against the limits of individual power, but up against the natural world order that dictates poor people to stay in the places they come from. The world is not there for the taking. It's literally beyond the border, and migrants have to risk everything to breach it. Therefore, the migrant journey is not only a physical transgression, but increasingly a social and political transgression too. It's a high-risk journey that, on a symbolic level, performs a kind of iconoclasm that has the potential to challenge current geopolitical order. To give some ethnographic context to these opening observations, I will turn to my long-term fieldwork in a small Ghanaian fishing village called Senyapreku in Ghana's central region. Here, especially young men have responded to the increasingly difficult circumstances by migrating to Libya and from there sometimes to Europe. This is a dangerous journey that is potentially rewarding but also claim many lives. Senyapreku is a small Guan-speaking Ifutu village where fishing is the main activity and income. Fishing is conducted in large dugout canoes in the Bay of Guinea, and the fishermen target mainly pelagic species like anchovies and mackerel. But for years now, canoe fishing in Senyapreku and in the whole West African region has been radically declining. Incidentally, the heavily subsidized EU fishing fleet is operating in many West African waters and are under much criticism for pulling the rock away from under the feet of local fishing communities like Senyapreku and thus enabling the exodus of young people that so many resources are otherwise put into stopping. But of course, the Europeans are not the only industrial fleet operating here. The Chinese, the Koreans, and the Russians, among others, are there. And then the illegal fishing is completely out of control. A recent report suggested that if West African countries could end the illegal fishing in their waters and harvest their own resources, they could make billions of dollars and generate up to 300,000 jobs and, of course, alleviate poverty and increased food security. But the effects of the decline are immediately felt on a social and economical level. Jobs are disappearing in the fishing industry. Families are struggling to feed their children. But also on an existential level, as the fishermen are concerned with changes in the marine environment. The composition of reality, as it were, is somehow disintegrating. In this way, many say that the sea has not just become difficult to predict, even capricious, but it has also undergone a physical transformation. Again, emphasizing how a kind of insufficient response to one's needs and desires sometimes changes one's perception of the environment. Now, fishermen argue that the sea is lighter, it's too swift and thin, as if no longer rich with promise and slow with familiarity, but indeed characterized by emptiness in both the literal sense and in the symbolic sense that it offers no shelter for local aspirations in a changing world. One of the strategies of dealing with this decline is high-risk migration to Europe. Some fishermen of Senjapreku, their fishing skills now almost obsolete, have found an opening as captains on the rickety boats that leave from Libya to Italy. Many fishermen have made it to Europe this way as smuggling boat captains, and many have died trying. It's not unusual in a West African context that reaffirming social worlds will bring one into the realm of sacrifice. The many Ghanaian migrants I've talked to about these issues are painfully aware of the dangers connected to high-risk migration. And they are not fooled by the photos of prosperity and happiness sent back to them by friends in Europe. They know they will suffer, and they also know that there is a real risk of not making it. But they choose to go anyway, and many say they are prepared to die for the hopes of advancement that migration offers, not only to them, but to their extended families too. Saying that, of course, does not mean that migrants are emotionally prepared for the horrors lurking in the desert or on the Mediterranean, and many are often traumatized by the events that await them. Incidentally, Baudrillard does not have a theory of subjective agency. There is not a point from which to rebel against the current predicament because there is no transcendence, no way to imagine another world. In hyper-reality, we are all extras in a reality show. But in hypo-reality, people are not necessarily content with living a life of poverty and degradation. They aspire to something more than what they have been thrown into. Perhaps they aspire to little else than being part of globalization, but that's still an action that requires imagination and agency, and that clashes violently with geopolitical order or perhaps disorder. Hope, as Bloch has argued, will not tolerate a dog's life. Last year, more than 5,000 people disappeared on the Mediterranean Sea trying to achieve a better life. More than 4,500 of these deaths happened off Libya on the route that most sub-Saharan migrants take, making this route the deadliest body of water in the world. Yet in Europe, we hear little of the complex interplay of circumstances that lead young people to take these dangerous decisions, and even less of the devastating consequences that migrant deaths have in the places that people come from. But what may transpire silently in the gray zones of the Euro-African borderlands as migrants disappear in the sea often have serious and long-lasting ramifications in the departure countries. Needless to say, there is no air of routine about the loss of a son, brother, or father in migrant departure countries. And in Senjapreku, as I will focus on now, what is lost in a far-off place is socially and politically reclaimed and reinstated in careful local magical and religious rituals. So how does migrant death challenge local worlds, and how do people deal with the ramifications? Sebastian disappeared on the Mediterranean in 2014, trying to reach Italy to find work. His wife, Alice, told Samuel and me, my longtime research assistant, that he tried to go because he was thinking about the future of his kids. He wanted to go to Europe to be able to put up a house for Alice and the children. Here, Alice said, you can work for a whole year and still have nothing. To Alice, the situation has been particularly painful because not only did she lose what she describes as a loving husband, but she is also blamed by the family of the husband for pushing him to take that dangerous trip. What happened was that when Sebastian was working in Libya, they had a fight over some money that he sent back to Senjapreku, and they were not on talking terms. The next thing she learned was that he had tried to go to Italy and disappeared in the sea. She's now in a very fragile situation because she lost her husband and a source of support for the children's nourishment, schooling, and health care. And not only that, but she's also blamed for the husband's death by his relatives. It's unfortunately often the case that the widow, and especially the kids, are hit hardest by migrant death. Because of the situation, Alice says she wakes up in the middle of the night and worries about the future. The priest in her church has advised her to worry less because he fears that she could hurt herself from the grief, and then her kids will have no one. It has really impacted our future, Alice said. I have no hope, and I worry what the future has in store for us. But I'm a Christian, and I have left everything to God so that God will inspire me to take care of the children. We also sat down and talked to Sebastian's father, who was in the process of obtaining information about the disappearance of his son. He agreed to let us join him as he went to consult a spiritual medium to try to make contact to the soul of the son to inquire if their worst fears had come true. Obviously, these journeys are not on record, and families are often in the dark over what happened, and they wait for years for information about migrants' whereabouts. But apart from the pain of not knowing, it's not considered wise to ignore the demands of the dead. Generally, in Ghana, the ancestors are held in the greatest reverence, and facilitating the soul's ascent to the spirit world of the ancestors from where they watch over and punish the living is a major concern of Ghanaian funeral rites. Sometimes people in Senyabreku say jokingly, we care more about the dead than we do about the living. Therefore, a soul hovering about homeless on the bottom of the Mediterranean or in the vast Sahara Desert, caught between two worlds, is not an acceptable state of affairs. The lost soul, feeling neglected, might in the end turn against its own family and cause accidents or death. But because of the uncertainties involved in high-risk migration, the family will not hasten to make a decision on the funeral unless clear information about a person's fate is somehow retrieved. So the father took us to Madame Sarah, a self-proclaimed prophetess, one of Senyabreku's many spirit mediums. Madame Sarah is a Christian lady, and she works with angel messengers that she can ask to travel to the far corners of the world to look for lost people. Other village mediums work with the Mocha, the little people, a group of mysterious gnome-like creatures that are believed to inhabit the bush. So Madame Sarah went into a trance and sent her spirit angels to the desert and to the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea, where they found the soul of Sebastian floating aimlessly around in the cold water. Through Madame Sarah, the son addressed his father and said that he was cold and that he was tired and that he wanted to come home. He cried and pleaded with the father to bring him home. He apologized to the father for not following his advice and told the father the story of how he tried to reach Italy but was captured and beaten and thrown in the water with his hands tied on his back. This came as a shock to the father, who was speechless and trembling and started wiping tears from his eyes. He told us later that he knew very well that something was not right, but that he felt ripped apart from hearing his son talking directly to him. The soul of Sebastian went on complaining that he was cold in the water and tired, so very tired, and that he wanted to come home to Senyabreku. Then suddenly Madame Sarah was thrown up against the wall as by an invisible hand, and she opened her eyes and asked her assistant to inform her about what had happened while she was under the spell. She then gave the father instructions on what to do that very night to pour libation and to initiate the funeral preparations. Madame Sarah then instructed us to walk the old man home because he should not be alone due to the nature of the shocking information. The next day, the father told us that he spent the night talking to some old friends, old Libyan veterans, and he told them what had happened, what he had learned about his son, and they had comforted him, and they had a drink, and it had dawned upon him then that the boy was really dead, and he felt very down about it and lost for words. Later that same night, he informed his wife about what had happened, and the wife cried all night. So this is a brief description of some of the initial actions taken in Senyabriku when trying to recover the whereabouts of a lost migrant. The point is that the reception of migrant death and disappearance in Senyabriku is perhaps not surprisingly radically different to the reception of migrant death in Europe, where we only hear abstract numbers in the media. Though it may not be surprising that families are shattered at home, the effort of the bereaved to deal with the situation, to rework and to make sense of loss, is crucial to understanding how migrant lives are reclaimed from the social and political borderlands of Europe. The lost soul is found and listened to, and the central theme of the funeral preparation is to bring home the lost soul to rest in Senyabriku. This includes also consulting the chief traditional priests that guard the major shrines of the village to the east, west, and north. The major village deities will then open the spiritual gates to allow the soul to return and take its place among the forefathers. It's precisely here one can find a form of counteraction, not a normative counteraction, but an existential counteraction to the absence of dignity and recognition that characterizes the unequal encounter with the border regimes of the privileged world. The emotional and psychological stakes aside, it is noticeable how these deaths entailed in undocumented migration are recognized on many different levels of village life, and how major efforts are set in motion to reclaim the dead and to make sure that the lost person's soul is socially and politically reclaimed as belonging not only to a family, but to the Guan community of Senyabriku. Moreover, the soul floating helplessly about in the forsaken borderlands of Europe is reconfigured in the religious cosmology of the village. Again, this form of local counteraction does not appear to be a critique of the political economy of the global world, inasmuch as it's a way of dealing with the dehumanizing effects of it, a way of dealing with ultimate loss in the face of powers that one has no control over. The body stays behind, but the soul returns to the family and the community, and the ascent to the eternal afterlife of the ancestors is meticulously facilitated. Again, travels in hypo-reality as opposed to hyper-reality are often short and underwhelming, and they come up against very real obstacles that seem to multiply and harden and postpone aspirations indefinitely. In fact, in hypo-reality, dreaming of another life is a dangerous affair. It will get you killed in the desert or on the Mediterranean Sea, or cause you to freeze to death in the Balkan tent camps. Unlike in hyper-reality, the flight of imagination is constantly kept in check by harsh reality and cold reason, undermined by the borders outside and within. So we have now seen how migrant deaths have serious local ramifications, but what about political ramifications? Though high-risk migration and death, like the ones we have just heard about from Senyabriku, are not, on the face of it, political acts, they do pose a challenge to political economy. they suggest a refusal to accept the stagnation of everyday life in the less fortunate parts of the world, a desire to make more out of life than what has been given, and thereby also a violent rejection of the global political economy. Because of this refusal of stasis, the expanding borders of Europe have become sites of immense human suffering, as we have seen in the Mediterranean. To return to migrant iconoclasm, it is in this light I argue that migrant death could be viewed as a form of iconoclasm, a tear in the global world order or disorder that has harsh human consequences on a local level and also, at times, severe political consequences for Europe. Second, that this form of iconoclasm talks about a crisis that is not necessarily a migration crisis, but a crisis of governance, both locally and globally, in the sense that people have perhaps lost belief that things will become better in their lifetime. And third, that this form of iconoclasm is the site of an ongoing, undecided struggle over the meaning of migrant death, from being seen as some kind of necessary evil in the maintenance of the liberal democracies of Europe, to paraphrase Mauricio Al-Bahari, to being devastating events that demand spiritual and existential counteraction at home. But in what way is political economy challenged by migrant brinkmanship and death on the Mediterranean? Following Baudrillard again, political systems are sensitive to near and massive displays of human suffering. Drawing on Mauss and Bataille, Baudrillard argues in Symbolic Exchange and Death that the willingness to give up or destroy everything one owns, one's life, is a very powerful form of sacrifice that can cause a rupture in a political system because it cannot be reciprocated by anything else, he argues, than the collapse and death of the system. In other words, political systems owe a symbolic debt for the death taking place under its jurisdiction. One example could be the 2013 Lampedusa disaster, where more than 350 people drowned off the tiny island of Lampedusa. The disaster led to the establishment of Mare Nostrum, the Italian naval and rescue operation on the Mediterranean, and the complete reversal of Berlusconi's hardline politics and cooperation with Colonel Gaddafi. Another example is the death of the 3-year-old Syrian boy, Aylan Kurdi, who washed up on a beach in Turkey and shocked Europe, and the subsequent collapse of the Dublin regulation, allowing refugees from Syria and Afghanistan to travel north freely. The boy died on September 2nd, 2015. 3 days later, Chancellor Angela Merkel said there was no limits to the number of refugees that Germany could take. So sometimes political economy comes under pressure from migrant death. But that's obviously not the complete picture, because most of the time political economy does not collapse, but lives well with migrant death on the Mediterranean. Migrants die all the time, and though it's seen as unfortunate, it's also understood to be the price of continued stability and prosperity in Europe, while at the same time Europe embraces universal ideas of humanitarianism, though often in a de-political and de-historical context that does not entail any serious intervention or action to prevent suffering. But why is it that at times migrant death matters politically and most of the times it does not matter? Maybe it's because that for the system to be put under pressure by sacrifice would presuppose that the migrant lives have genuine value in the first place. But often humanity appears to be concentrated on our side. Migrant death, on the contrary, are framed in dehumanizing terms which eliminate moral responsibility and obligation. Most of the time, there is no reaction at all, and other times there are sudden ruptures that have significant political consequences. But on the level of governance, we are seeing a contradiction. The modern inclination to protect and manage life, to intervene on behalf of life, to exercise power over life, or biopower in Foucault's phrasing, as opposed to older forms of sovereignty that rule by death and atrocity. Though, as Foucault argues or acknowledges, we have seen these different forms of sovereignty living along each other in, for instance, murderous totalitarian regimes or in the European colonial administrations. Interestingly, to Foucault, because power is increasingly the power to intervene in biological life, death is the limit, or even the end of power, the moment when the individual escapes power. But perhaps there's more to it than that. Perhaps power is fundamentally challenged by migrant brinkmanship and death. Perhaps we should understand power as being kept in check by death, as existentially challenged by death. This seems to be Baudrillard's argument. To avoid ruptures, political power seeks to govern death by confiscating it, while at the same time it allows its subjects to live out the slow social and symbolic death of migrant underworlds in the borderlands, in Libyan prisons, or in the underground economy. Whereas the sudden, violent sacrifice of one's life, the gift of death, on the other hand, has the potential to shake political power. Could we see the humanitarian rescue missions in the Mediterranean in this light? As not only aimed at saving the migrant lives in correspondence with European humanitarian values, but also as a form of intervention to govern life, modern biopower, but also as a way of keeping migrants from giving death on the doorsteps of Europe. I'm not saying, of course, that rescue missions are bad, but they are to some extent contradictory. Immediate attention is given to migrants' biological well-being and to photo opportunities and to making sure that they do not pass away, and much less attention is given to their social and political or legal rights. Many resources then go into the process of shipping them off to the countries from where they came or into the European underground economies without contracting further moral, legal, or political obligations. The biological death is substituted with a symbolic and social death. And could we see the moving and rapid externalization of borders in this light? And should we include the proliferation of borders and the ultimate internalization of borders as attempts to preempt or confiscate death by pushing borders and boundaries deep into Africa and creating a distant battlefield beyond public scrutiny and moral visibility? Externalization of borders not only displaces legal and political obligation, but also neutralizes Baudrillard's deep grammar of reciprocity that calls for a symbolic countergift in return for the migrant gift of death. By displacing migrant death and suffering to far-off places, migrants' sudden and violent sacrifices are made to disappear from our moral radar. So what kind of crisis are we seeing here? Is it a refugee crisis or a migration crisis or something completely else? If we take as a point of departure the assertion that high-risk migration and death is a form of iconoclasm, then what kind of symbolic order is it that the migrants are tearing down as they head into the desert and across the Mediterranean and risk their lives in the process? Again, there are many reasons for leaving, and it really can't be reduced to a question of border control and lack of border control, or to poverty or to conflict situations alone. All these things matter taken together, and Europe is both seen as a place of safety and a greener pasture for people who really need to see change. But about what kind of crisis we are seeing. First of all, It's a rejection of a global order where some people are born into poverty and doomed to live out their whole lives in poverty. A global order or disorder where the gap between rich and poor widens and the few options available, like fishing in Senyabriku, are disappearing. A privileged, hyper-real world, increasingly detached from your reality, and a world weighed down by too much reality or hyper-reality. Second, from the point of West African migrants, there's an explicit critique of local political governance at the heart of the decision. They are critical of their own government's ability to turn around the situation, to create jobs and the money they need for the kind of life that globalization has promised. They no longer believe that if they stay and grit their teeth, jobs and money and technology will flow their way. This is, of course, also a critique of the global development paradigm that promised Western-style futures if only people waited long enough. They are simply not seeing enough reasons for staying put and have no patience that things will get better soon or perhaps in their children's generation. One further political challenge is the fact that high-risk migration and migrant iconoclasm have, to a growing extent, been exploited by transit countries to put pressure on Europe. Again, meaning that we have to expand our understanding of what drives migration. The form and extent of high-risk migration can be influenced by transit countries' own interest. Turkey, for instance, has played on the fear of migration and refugees to obtain financial and political goals that were difficult to imagine only a few years ago. Egypt is demanding a similar deal to Turkey, and Morocco could very well be next. So migrants and refugees are becoming leverage in a geopolitical game that Europe does not seem to be winning at the moment. The solution seems to be writing checks to countries that Europe does not have a long-term interest in supporting and using that money to build higher walls around an increasingly poor continent where many young people are losing hope. One could argue that that's not a migration crisis, but a deeply political crisis, and that migrant iconoclasm questions fundamental aspects of current global governance. To end on iconoclasm as a feature of hyper-reality, the death-defying migrant journeys represent people taking action in the hope that the borders that confine them to a life of stagnation can be transgressed, the very reason for traveling in the first place, and not just geographical borders, but social and political borders too, in the sense that this migrant brinkmanship, risking one's life in the desert and on the sea, the price of that is a complete reversion of one's social status, becoming someone at home by refusing to accept an order that otherwise appears totally unchangeable. Or as Bourdieu argues, the symbolic transgression of a frontier has a liberatory effect in its own right because in it enacts the unthinkable. And clearly these journeys have a deep symbolic meaning. It's possible to shake off the stasis of village life, and for all the might and power of European nation states and private security companies, it's possible to cross the borders, the geographical, social, and political borders that impose these limits and subordination on people in the global south. The resulting suffering and death on the borders, though not political acts per se, become powerful acts of iconoclasm that ask questions of both current geopolitical order and the sincerity of European commitment to humanitarian values. To the migrants, these journeys, however dangerous and sometimes fatal, in fact because they are precisely that kind of investment, represent a margin of freedom to make more out of the lives into which they have been thrown. They literally put their lives on the line in order to obtain a life they think is worth living. Hope, again, does not accept a dog's life. But they are up against a situation where, as Sigmund Bauman has argued, mobility and its absence designate the new late modern or postmodern polarization of social conditions. The top in this hierarchy live in an era of space-time compression. They are de facto extraterritorial and enjoy an unprecedented freedom from physical obstacles and unheard-of ability to move and act from a distance, whereas the lower strata of the world experience increasing physical restraints and endless waiting or space-time expansion. The lowest in this new world order revolving around mobility are annexed to the land they live on and watch on as the sole locality they inhabit drift away from under their feet. This development is very visible in Senjabreku as the fleet of foreign trawlers from China and Europe lie on the horizon like a chokehold on the village. The circumstances of life in what I have here called hypo-reality is full of physical obstacles and shackles on social and individuals' aspirations. The walls of confinement grow higher and higher, separating migrants from sites of desire and advancement. When they take matters into their own hands, like Sebastian and Alice, they are seen as trespassers, and their deaths are hardly newsworthy. But they continue to go it alone, despite the way the cards are stacked against them, because hope refuses to die out. In these acts, we see a certain migrant resilience and ingenuity that defies the spatial separation of the haves and the have-nots, or what I have here termed migrant iconoclasm in the Euro-African borderlands. It's a feature of hyper-reality that one comes up against obstacles that cannot be surmounted. It's also a feature that lives are short and underwhelming. But here, too, we see a certain counteraction that reinstates meaning and dignity. Existentially, the process of magically and religiously reclaiming and circumscribing a person lost on the Mediterranean appears to claw back a modicum of control in the face of the necropolitics of the extended Euro-African borderlands. A lost migrant, from a Senjabreku perspective, is a social and political subject belonging to a family and a community, someone whose life and death is recognized. Thank you. Yes, so I suppose we have time for a few questions.
Yes, we have plenty of time.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I really liked your hypo reality. I guess I have
Yeah.
What would Jean Baudrillard think about your innovative concept?
Good question. Actually, the way what happened was that I was shocked by the election of Trump in the U.S. to be honest, like so many other people. And at the time, I was rereading some Baudrillard, and I always found it very difficult to read. It's full of hyperbole and exaggeration and flamboyancy. I mean, it's really sometimes very also just difficult to understand what he's talking about, basically. But certainly, it looked almost like prophetic in a way, the way he was kind of seeing a person like Trump emerge 40 years ago when that was not likely. And then there has been people working on the election in the U.S. and saying that this was the first postmodern president, you know, the first hyper-real president. And then I started reading Baudrillard again and to see if there's something in it. And then, as I mentioned in the talk, of course, I came across Susan Sontag's critique of Baudrillard, which I felt was very strong, that not everybody lives in a hyper-reality, and it's a provincial argument, basically, because it's you know, from a point of view of the Western, from Europe, U.S. point of view. And then I felt, but what kind of reality is it really that the migrants live in this, that they don't have papers, they live in these crappy circumstances, they're constantly, you know, facing obstacles and barriers, and, you know, they're in no way freed from reality. Quite the contrary, they're weighed down by too much reality. And then I kind of realized that a lot of their lives are characterized by being sub, in some subhuman, substandard, sub-Saharan even, interestingly. And I thought, well, this is an under form of reality, so obviously it was a hypo-reality. And what would Baudrillard think about it? I don't think he would care about that because he's not interested, especially in Africa, to my as far as I know, or in anywhere else except from Paris and the U.S. So I don't think that would be very much his argument, but I'm more following Susan Sontag's argument actually here. So I was provoked by Baudrillard and also felt there was a need to kind of talk about a different form of reality. And then is it an opposition? What I've tried to argue here is that it's a kind of connection. There's a connection that if you look at Dubai, for instance, the perfect hyper-real society, if you've seen the images of it, a brand new town rising in the desert, kind of paraphrasing, citing architecture from all over the world, but there's no real, it's a simulacra in many ways. But then you look, who's building Dubai? Look at the sweatshops and the people where the migrants work. I mean, migrants from all over the world live in this system where they have to hand in their passports to a chaperone, basically, who will keep their passport. They are restricted from walking in the city. They can only walk to certain areas and they have no rights and so on. That whole kafala system of the Gulf states. So that's hyper. I mean, so they live together in a sense and are interconnected and maybe actually mutually constitutive of each other. So that would probably be my argument. This is something, actually, the first time I'm talking about this. It's an article I'm trying, or actually a preface to a new book I'm trying to get together. So I'm really happy if you have comments on some of the things I put out here, because it's really testing the waters a little bit. Yes?
Okay. Maybe I think Timo was first.
Okay. Thank you. This was a very thought-provoking paper. And the contrast you draw between hyper-reality and hypo-reality made me think about another condition in today's world, which is the life expectancy, which has been shown to depend on class and mm-hmm. Socioeconomic status. And one aspect of hyper-reality, at least in the United States, is the wish that you can live and go on consuming as long as you can. And there is even a graveyard in California where people are still heard talking about their life even if they are in their grave. So it's like a very body art kind of setting.
Right, right.
And then contrast that with places where people have a very low life expectancy and also face the suddenness of life in a fairly young age, so that life, death comes very quickly. And when I have witnessed such situations, you know, I hear some people saying, you know, you don't have to fear death if you have not sinned. So people have this recourse to a transcendence, you know, death kind of confronts you with the transcendence.
Yes.
And I thought that if there is a different kind of, you know, attitude towards death, you know, death as being part of life, not in the sense that it transports you to another reality, but it actually just terminates this existence and shows the sort of like blatant inequality of people's situation in the world. That would be somehow like hyper-reality doesn't have this transcendence, if I understood your, you correctly. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there is, like, Baudrillard would also work in the sense that the type of hyper-reality replaces transcendence with a confrontation with the secular society, which does not live up to what it promises, basically, to take care of you and to improve your life and so on. And this must be so obvious to so many people in the world.
Well, very, very good question or comment. There's definitely something about death and also transcendence, as I mentioned. Baudrillard's argument is that there is no transcendence in hyper-reality. You cannot imagine another form of life outside of this hyper-real society. But in hypo-reality, and of course when I use these concepts, I don't use them in a kind of synthetic way. It's more like vehicles of trying to understand empirical reality. I don't think there's a one-to-one relationship between hyper-reality and the people I study. It's a kind of tool or vehicle to kind of understand some things that is going on. I definitely need to work on why is it that in hyper-reality there's a very strong dream, very strong desire to make more out of life, even though so many constraints are put in to stopping people from doing exactly that. So what is the relation to transcendence in hyper-reality as opposed to hyper-reality? That would be a very good question. And death, of course, would be a good starting point to look at that.
Thank you. Yes, very interesting talk. Continuing a little bit about the hypo-reality, how would you see the relationship between that and concepts of abjection, for example, which have often been used for precisely these kinds of people that are sort of below lumpen? Leads me to ask that question is about what, in your view, is causing the hypo-reality? Where is it coming from? Is it coming from a combination of how people feel their life ought to be and they don't like it, they're being constrained from it? Or is it mostly these external constraints? And if those external constraints exist, where do they come from? And related to that, Ruben Anderson's work on Illegality Inc. and the idea that really an awful lot of these people have been generated by the very systems that are put in there to control them and at great profit to the organizations that are causing those security systems, so that we may have had people who were coming from sub-Saharan Africa through Libya in large numbers, but we didn't know because they weren't being controlled in earlier decades. And finally, just one question about, you know, what can we do about this situation? Would naming every death change things?
Right. Abjection. I think I primarily know the term from James Ferguson's work, and I've also worked with it, and it's definitely not something opposite to the notion of hyperreality that I'm still exploring and developing, but would be a feature of it, I think. It's an attempt to kind of phrase or to describe, kind of give a conceptual take on migrant lives in this, in a changing world, and maybe it has a little bit of a bigger scope than objection, but basically is talking about the same thing. There's no, you know, I could definitely recruit objection as into the umbrella of hyperreality. Where does this hyperreality come from? Very difficult question. You know, where does development, you know, where does this political development come from? You know, I feel most comfortable talking about the village of Senyabriku that I know best, and there are so many, of course, people. Like when you work on African migration, people will ask you, why do Africans migrate? And you know, there are it's a huge continent. There are various countries and reasons for leaving. And when you have a boat going to Libya, there would be an individual reason for every person sitting in that boat. But if you look at Senyabriku, I think I've also tried to describe here that the decline in fishing is really important to look at because this is precisely a situation that has been influenced by global economy. And it's not just a group of desperate people running for their lives with no clue about what's going on. It's very directly connected to changes in the global economy. And the fact that, for instance, in Europe, we have exhausted our own fishing resources to the extent that we buy licenses to fish in West Africa. I mean, instead of reducing the capacity of the fishing fleet, which would be the best solution, but we can't do that because of pressure from Spain and other places, we just buy other countries' fishing rights. And so here you see what happens when you put pressure on very fragile communities like that. And it's, you know, it's been known for years and years and years that the West African fishing is under huge pressure, and not just from Europe, but also, of course, from overfishing and from pollution and from climate change. So I think part of my work has been with this village has been to show how these many different domains are interlocked, creating suddenly this window of opportunity, really, that it was to Senyabriku fishermen, that they could go into Libya and work as captains on the smuggling boats. But that all these kind of interlocking situations created what Norbert Elias calls a figuration, you know, a kind of expanded social field that made travels to Europe, you know, logical to some extent. So that's very important, I think, to keep looking at also the economical reasons for this happening. And then, of course, there's also some internal reasons for this happening, like mismanagement of, you know, corruption and bad governance in many African states and so on. And, of course, many reasons. But I feel most comfortable, again, talking about this village that I know very well and the region that I know very well. I guess if you look at Senegal, where also people are migrating from, or Ethiopia, there would be different explanations. Ruben Anderson's work, I'm very familiar with it, and I'm a big fan of his, and I can see his point that the security regime is to some extent producing what they propose to fight. It's a good point, point taken. I have no issue with that. I can't write what the last question.
Would it make a difference if all the...
Oh, yeah. It's a good question. You know, I'm not sure it would. I've argued elsewhere that Europe suffers from what I called social prosopagnosia. Social prosopagnosia. Prosopagnosia is this medical condition where you have normal sight, but you cannot recognize faces. I mean, you cannot recognize anybody who have normal sight. Prosopagnosia. So I've argued that we suffer from social prosopagnosia. We cannot see their faces. And it's very difficult for us to relate to people dying on the Mediterranean as human beings with, you know, real lives and real families and so on. But then again, sometimes we see, like, the island Kurdi situation, that it sends shockwaves to Europe, and suddenly we see ourselves in a whole different light that we don't like very much. But most of the time, we live very well with that situation. So it's a weird situation that I'm trying to grasp. Why is it that sometimes these migrant deaths matter and can really shake the foundation of Europe, create an existential crisis in European political systems, and most of the time it doesn't matter? So if anybody has any, you know, clue, I mean, there will be NGOs and other researchers like myself trying to give a name and a voice to people dying on the sea. So there is this kind of attempt to humanize migrant death. But whether it matters very much, I don't know. I hope so. Was there another
one? Thanks. I have a comment based on my own experience in Ghana. And actually it has to do with this last question about the naming of the dead. And I've worked in Ghana, but not on this topic, but, you know, in Ghana everybody talks about this, so I've listened to a lot of stories from people who...
Where in Ghana?
In Nkoranza, in Prangahawa region. Uh-huh. So I've listened to a lot of stories from people who have gone to Libya and back, or even to Italy and back, and so on. And what caught my attention in those stories was that it seemed that this kind of erasure of social identities takes place as people leave home, cross the desert, then cross the Mediterranean. For instance, one guy was telling me about the preparations that you take before you enter the boat. And he was telling me that, you know, the only things that you are allowed to wear is a T-shirt and a pair of boxer shorts. You can take a loaf of bread and then a bottle of water. But there will be no identity papers, there will be no rings, no bracelets or anything that might give a hint of your identity. And this, the reason for this is that when you then reach Lampedusa, and in case you get caught, the authorities will arrest you, then you will apply for an asylum, and then you have to have a story ready that why you need an asylum. And then any kind of, like, real information about your background would then contradict possibly the story, so you kind of want to make yourself a clean slate that, mm-hmm. you know, you can mm-hmm. tell just about anything about yourself in order to get the asylum. And in this sense, kind of what you mentioned there, that when the rescue boats come and they meet the people at the sea, that they attend to the biological existence of those people primarily. And one reason for this is that, you know, that's pretty much what they have there. Mm. And because these people are not coming there with their social identities, with their passports or anything like that. Actually, they would prefer not to be met by anybody. Mm. And then back home in Ghana, of course, this constitutes a huge dilemma since, you know, if they want to find out what has happened to their lost relatives, this kind of anonymity then makes it, you know, even much, much harder to find out if there's even any possibility to find out anything about that.
Yeah, it's a great comment, and it's a very important one also, and one I've noticed also in my own work. It's not just that migrants are kind of dehumanized or seen as non-persons in the borderlands of Europe, but they also strip themselves of identity. It's part of the preparation that you move in to these borderlands and you change your name, your age, and you throw away any identity papers, anything that can be used against you. So that's definitely a very interesting perspective. And when you talk to, I remember interviewing one Ghanaian in, I think it was in Italy, and I asked his age, and he said, "You want my real age or my refugee age?" Right? Because obviously they know that if you're young, you have a better chance of getting asylum. So they, of course, work the system. I mean, they're not. I mean, they will do what they put themselves in whatever position that they think is most helpful in order to somehow gain a foothold in Europe. So that's part of the deal, of course. And many, I mean, Ghanaians are not entitled to asylum and will get rejected. But usually what they do in Italy is that they, if people don't believe their stories, they will claim they're from Sierra Leone or somewhere else, that they're refugees, Liberia maybe. And if they get rejected, then they apply again or object to that rejection, and then they slip into the underground economy and just disappear. And in Italy, up till recently, what they did was that if people were thrown out of the country, they just showed them to the train, to the railway station, and say, "Go home to Africa." And then, of course, people just went to their friends, various places in Italy. So there's a constant kind of game here where the migrants try to, or the Ghanaian migrants. It's different, of course, if you work with the Eritreans, for instance. I work with the Eritreans in Libya, and they, of course, have high recognition rate as refugees, so they also have a completely different background. And but Ghanaians know very well that they will not get asylum in Europe, and they will not be allowed to get a green card or to work here. So they maneuver the system, and part of that is getting rid of anything that can tie you down to a certain ethnicity or age or whatever. And I guess also symbolically, existentially, I mean, you go there to change your life, right? You go there to become a new person. So you shed your skin, in a sense, you know. And the price is really high. If you actually make it to Europe and find a job, even the most shitty job you can imagine, you can start sending money back, and it will kind of be a complete social transformation from being a nobody at home. People will start calling you, asking you for advice in family matters and involving you in all kinds of stuff that was just not possible before, because you're just a young boy, like a lazy young boy doing nothing, sitting down. So it's a complete transformation of one's position in many ways. It's very desirable. When they die, obviously, they don't have any ID on them, usually. But it's not like people don't know they're leaving. Typically in Libya, you'll be part of a larger group, and they will know that, you tried to leave on this and that date. And also you will call your friends in Italy and saying, "I'm coming." So if the boat is not arriving, then some people will know that something is not, you know, right. They will never have precise information as to what happened, which is also part of the problem. There's no precise information. I mean, you can never really know what happened on the sea. And sometimes people also disappear. And for instance, when I do field work in Niger, I work with a group of stranded migrants from Ghana, and one of them has stayed 18 years in Niger without calling home, because he has nothing. He lost everything and just sits under a tree and plays the lottery. And his kids are grown up now, and he has a wife. And he said, I will never call them unless I have something in my pocket, he says. So unless somehow he gets a little money and can come home and save face, he will not go. He said he'd rather die in Niger than come home empty-handed. So there's a whole group of people in all the kind of transit points and places in the desert and in North Africa that are just waiting, and they can't call home and tell anybody what happened. And they can't move further. So a lot of stranded people also is part of the story. Yes?
I wanted to ask about your use of hyper-reality for the experience of the northern countries. Because I wonder to what extent that... Sorry. I wonder to what extent... That really describes what's going on.
Mm.
I think it did describe a moment in Baudrillard's time, in a way. But if I think about the countries, European countries I know best, and I think about people's understanding, as I know them, of refugees, of what's happening, of the arrivals of migrants and so on, I'm not sure that hyper-reality and the idea that we're all extras, for example, is what they, how they really perceive it. Mm. That I think there is also an idea of a transformation taking place that people are very much concerned about, at the same time as they don't know how to hold on. And I'm thinking about the UK, I'm thinking about the ways in which refugees are being integrated in Sweden, I'm thinking about refugees in Berlin. These are the areas that I know about. So I'm just wondering whether hyper-reality really captures what is happening and whether there isn't something else that needs to be thought about.
Right.
You know, as you're looking at deindustrialization, as you're looking at sort of rises of xenophobia and things like that.
Right. I'm talking about hyper-reality and hypo-reality, right?
Okay, I'm talking about the Baudrillard idea of hyper-reality, whether that's really still...
I'm sure that needs a revision. It's 40 years ago or something that he wrote about that. But I also think that some parts of it are more relevant now. I mean, I can see why when he wrote about it that people would think this is science fiction. But that was before, you know. I mean, I guess it was before the internet. I mean, it was a long time ago that he was talking about media-saturated worlds. So anyways, I just found it fascinating that he sort of was dealing with those ideas at a time when... the internet and all what we have now was less developed. I'm again, these are not kind of when I use a concept like hyper-reality or Baudrillard's hyper-reality, I don't take them as being fully covering social worlds or empirical reality. I really believe that. Concepts cannot do that. I mean, I use concepts in order to invigorate, to animate social life, but I never think that they are precise and they will never empty the social world or cover the social world in any way. So I would constantly be on the lookout for these cracks or these fissures or these problems that there are with concepts and see what they what we're missing. So yes, I would definitely not... argue that hyper-reality is the final say on social reality or anything like that. And actually, I tend to like categories or concepts that has an element of caricature in them, because I think with caricature, there's always a core of truth to caricature. But you're not talking about the world as it is, but as a kind of distorted way of what it is. And then you go back to the real world and look at it one more time. So there's a kind of double return to the world in caricature that I like better than categories that are, should we say, synthetic with the world. And that's why I like, for instance, Foucault and Bourdieu. I think there's an element of caricature to many of their concepts. But that's just my interpretation. I would definitely encourage, you know, further research into this, and that's what I'm doing also, and I'm trying to kind of see where I can take this notion of hyper-reality. And I'm not finished with it, and I'll keep developing it. And I like your comment, and I will take it into account.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation, and I really like the concept of hyper-reality. And I was wondering whether you consider using it in a sort of historical way, because I think Europe is suffering from historical amnesia and the role of colonialism and the vile oppression of basically the majority of the world in the Southern Hemisphere. So in many ways, we tend to analyze the incoming migrants, immigrants into Europe and try to come up with ideas of why they're migrating. And when you think historically, like broad historical patterns, hyper-reality was at the core of colonial system. So you had entire nations, entire communities living, you know, subjugated by powers, whether it's, you know, the German history of Namibia is not that rosy, and then, of course, Great Britain and the colonial past, Belgian genocide. So, I mean, you pretty much can pick any country that's wealthy now, and you will sort of see the levels of oppression that they inflicted over the last hundreds of years. So I wonder if that could be sort of stretched to, you know, in a sort of geopolitical manner. Just an idea, and I wonder what you're thinking about it. Thanks.
Very interesting comment. I share with you the notion that colonial discourse is not that as far away as we like to think it is. I mean, when you when I heard Theresa May, actually, when she was still the Minister of the Interior in the UK, it's a few years ago, now everybody's saying it, saying that we should not save migrants on the Mediterranean because that just means that more people come. So basically, we should let them die, and then the rest will kind of understand the message. That's the language of colonialism. You know, the savages only understand violence. I mean, it's very clear to me that these discourses are not that, not as distant as we like to think. About the hyper-reality, I mean, I mentioned migrant death on the Mediterranean, but we're seeing some very, you know, violent and crazy things going on that are directed on migrants and migrant lives and migrant bodies. I mean, I'm talking about the situation in the Gulf states, also in Libya, like slave auctions where you can actually buy migrants. I mean, actual slave, I mean, auctions where people are brought down and people come to buy them, and you see that in the Gulf states with the Nepalese maids, and in Libya with sub-Saharan Africans. And recently there was a, you know, a feature on the BBC about organ trafficking in Egypt, and interviews with migrants that, you know, sold their organs in order to further their travel. I mean, what kind of reality are we talking about here? It's a very harsh, very dark reality that seems to be preying especially on migrants. So that's, you know, things that I want to go deeper into and try to understand what kind of conditions have made this hyper-reality, you know, suddenly emerge, or not suddenly emerge, actually exploring the historical links would be very useful. So, yeah, thanks for that. All right. Thank you. Thanks for all your wonderful questions.